name Coin, and this time we're collaborating with experts when auditing complex financial statement line items, and we have a chartered accountant that will be joining us. Runyararu Makanza is a technical audit specialist with more than 5 years of experience, a chartered accountant, registered audited, and holds an MCOM in international accounting. She's enthusiastic about auditing standards and quality in audit engagement. Her passion is to contribute towards efficient and effective ways of applying auditing requirements by providing guidance and training. She has experience in formulating, implementing, training on the audit methodology, auditing standards and audit tools. She's also involved in engagement quality reviews. Runyararu is currently a senior manager in the technical division at SMG Grant Thornton, where she continues to enhance and drive the appropriate application of auditing standards, methodology and tools. She is a technical advisor in the Independent Regulatory Board of Auditors, IRBA, Committee for Auditing Standards. Thank you very much, Runyararu.
Thank you so much, GJ, for the introduction, and thank you so much for the opportunity. I'm glad to be here and speaking to actuaries. I think I'm just the odd one out today here. But what I'm going to be talking about today, colleagues, is collaboration with you as our experts when we are auditing complex financial statements. And because this is actually a retirement matters seminar, I'm actually going to then be focusing more on what really relates to this session, which is mainly IS19, your pension funds, etc. What am I going to be talking about? I'm going to be speaking through the auditor's responsibilities, which I think some of you already know, but because we just want to discuss more about our collaboration together, I was happy when Corneille was actually discussing conflict and all, and I was actually thinking, are we the ones actually causing this conflict or are we not? Is it a conflict between the actuaries and us? Is it a conflict between the actuaries themselves when they are now discussing what the auditors have actually then said? So I'm going to talk about that, the auditor's responsibility, the audit evidence that we actually need for us to get to our solution, for us to get to our opinion. I'm also going to just speak a little as well about materiality. I'm going to talk about sampling. I'm sure some of you have heard about it. I'm going to then speak to accounting estimates and then how we then bring in you as our experts in the audits as well. And why these topics are really, and why am I here? I think it's really mainly because of these questions that you're seeing here. I think some of you have actually asked these questions, or you actually have more questions really that you ask us as the auditors when we come and ask certain questions. What does the auditor do? Why are they asking questions about my calculation? Why are they challenging my assumption? What do they really know about the assumptions that I've actually used? What is this materiality that they are talking about? And what impact does it have on the calculations, on the valuations that you would have done? And you've heard about sampling as well. What is that? What is it that we call sampling? And what is material misstatement? I'm not going to be going through this into too much detail, but just to try and maybe give an understanding of what we do and why we do it, so that at least we don't have as much conflicts, if we may call them conflicts. So on the auditor's responsibility, our responsibility really is to obtain that reasonable assurance about whether the financial statements as a whole are free from material misstatements. And I put in bold the whole and material, because that's what you hear, I think, often from us, and we want to express an opinion that the financial statements are prepared in all material respects, according to the financial reporting framework. And with that, we then also give our management, our entity, a report. We communicate to them our findings according to our standards as well. And some of those findings really might be coming from you as those experts that we have actually collaborated with in auditing certain financial statement line items. Okay, and then maybe someone is actually asking themselves, why is it a reasonable assurance? Why don't you give an absolute? What is it that you call a reasonable assurance? It is really a high assurance and not necessarily an absolute assurance. I'll tell you why we actually don't give an absolute assurance. And this, we actually obtain it when we obtain sufficient, appropriate audit evidence. And this is actually one of the reasons why we then come and say, how have you done this? May I please have the data that you've used? So that at least we can actually have that audit evidence for ourselves. But I'm going to speak a little bit more about audit evidence as well. So we obtain that audit evidence, and it has to be sufficient and appropriate to reduce our audit risk. So what we don't want at the end of the day as auditors is to say the financial statements are not materially misstated when they were actually materially misstated, right? So that's the audit risk that we actually need to then reduce to an appropriate level. That audit risk, a function of risk of material misstatement, I think you could have heard what we actually then do. We understand an entity, we get to understand whether there might be a risk of material misstatement within a certain financial statement line item. I've given an example there of a leave provision that we think might be materially misstated because we've understood the entity, we've understood how the accounting estimate is actually made. And so in there, we've identified that it's complex. It might be complex. So there might actually be a risk in this financial statement line item and thus leave provision. And that would be then the risk that we then raise and say, okay, fine, so how do we then respond to that, where the detection risk now comes in, and then we then formulate an audit procedure that then responds to that risk that we would have identified in that FSLI. And I've given an example there that we may then decide, because of the complexity, we may then decide that we are going to then engage an expert in actually responding to that risk. And this is the question that I was just asking to say, why not absolute assurance? This is really because of the inherent limitations that are within an audit. I think Cornel also just touched on some of it around uncertainties with accounting estimates. So because of those uncertainties, we cannot come and say we are absolutely sure that this amount is correct. So we end on the reasonable assurance and whether it is material or not. Okay, that is just a bit about our responsibility. That's why then we come and ask a bit of questions. So on audit evidence, it's just not a lot that I'm going to talk through here, but this is what is very important for us. We need information to support our opinion. We need information that then says our financial statements are not materially misstated. This is the support that we've got. And that is why we come and ask for certain information from you as our experts, because we need that sufficient, appropriate audit evidence. Not going so much into sufficiency and appropriateness, but sufficient is really the quantity of the information that we then use, and appropriateness is the quality. How relevant is it? How reliable is the information? And some of that information actually would have maybe come from an expert as well. So it might be really measuring or valuing the post-employment benefit obligation because of the complexities that are in there. You would have been engaged maybe by your client, and we then come in and say, how has this been developed? And we also bring in our experts as well, just to get to the sufficient and appropriate audit evidence that we need for that same number that you are actually valuing that is going to get into the financial statements. All right, materiality. I think just had some discussions with other people during lunch, and they were talking about the auditors just said this amount is materially misstated, when me as an actuary, I actually know that it is, and I'm asking the question, what are you basing your conclusion on? And there was a mention as well around the auditors just come and say, this is what you're required to do, this is material. So the financial statements or the number is actually misstated. So what are we saying when we speak about materiality? In simple terms, we're just saying what is important to the financial statement users. That's what we are really talking about. So we are concerned about any omissions that may happen or misstatements that may occur in a certain financial statement line item that are expected to influence the decisions of the users of the financial statements. So if we use our principles and methodologies to calculate that, to determine that, and we then also look for it, use it quantitatively and also qualitatively. I've just spoken about using our methodology to determine the number that we then say, if this FSLI, if this financial statement line item, if this post-retirement obligation is more than this number, it is material and it needs to be looked at, it needs to be tested. And also we look at what we call qualitative factors as well. Sometimes you'll find that a certain line item is not as huge, but we are still looking at it. It might be because of the qualitative aspects within that financial statement line item, and we have to look at it. Does the misstatements have an effect on any maybe key ratios that we look at, debt covenants that we look at? So we then have to also look at that amount. When do we then use materiality? You can see there we use it when we're planning our audits. I've spoken about a certain number being above a certain amount, then it means that we gotta have to test that number. We use it when performing our audits. You see, it also affects our sampling as well. When evaluating the effect of identified misstatements, maybe we've got the management's point estimate and we've got our own point estimate. What is the difference between the point estimates that are there, and is it material? So that's where we also then come in and use that materiality amount. Evaluating the effect of uncorrected misstatements, if there is any that management or our client has actually not corrected. So we actually look at that as well, and then forming an opinion. Remember, I said our opinion is actually saying our financial statements materially misstated. So that's where that materiality amount is also coming into play. Just on a high level, not into so much detail what I'm speaking about, and I'm hoping, I'm trying to get to how do we resolve our conflicts. Sampling. On sampling, this we use it when we are actually then responding to those risk assessment, to those risks that we'll have identified. And we've got a number of ways to select items to test, which sampling is one of them. We might actually be selecting all items to test. We might select specific items. Or we actually perform what we call sampling, which we then use our methodologies to help us to actually then calculate the number of items that we are going to be testing. And as you can see there, we are testing, we are applying our audit procedures to less than 100% of the items, and all items in that population have got a chance of selection. And what's important here is to know that or realize that everything has got a chance of being selected, and also we can be able then to draw conclusions for the whole population because we've used some statistical methods, etc., to then come up with the sample size that we're actually going to be looking at. All right. Okay, then into accounting estimates, which is really the big part of this this session, where we are then collaborating with you on how we are going to be to come up with the correct figure that we are going to, or a reasonable figure that we are going to get into the financial statements. So, as you can see, they have just put like the whole product, a whole audit process that we follow. When we're auditing accounting estimates, it's like a mini audit itself because of the complexities around the estimates themselves, where we start from the planning section on the risk assessment procedures, where we actually need to understand what accounting estimates are they in an entity, what the accounting policies that they are following, are they using a management expert? All that information then helps us to then identify and assess any risks that are then related to certain financial statement line items, especially the post-retirement obligations. And then that will then help us to respond to the risks that we'll have identified. And then we evaluate and conclude around the estimates and also do some reporting and communicating as well, which we'll do in conjunction with whoever would have engaged to help us in auditing the accounting estimates. I think this, you all know what is an accounting estimate, really a monetary amount that is subject to estimation uncertainty. So, and this is actually in accordance to the accounting reporting framework that is applicable for that entity. And these actually vary in nature, and management actually have to make them because you don't have an observable amount. You don't have a price. You don't have a cost. So you actually need to then estimate an amount because it's needed in the financial statements. And, of course, the standards will also guide us on how best we can actually come up with the number. And we need sufficient appropriate audit evidence around the reasonability of the accounting estimates. Are the disclosures as well correct? Are the disclosures reasonable? Are they according to the financial reporting framework? You also see that some accounting estimates, you will see we bring an expert, some we don't. So our responses really are dependent on the uncertainties that are within that estimate, the complexity, the subjectivity as well within those estimates. So you may find that some procedures are actually extensive, more extensive than some procedures for certain accounting estimates. Estimation uncertainty, really, there is inherent lack of precision there, so you can't really say this is the actual cost. So some actuaries have to come in and help us determine the amount and eventually audit the amount. And on complexity and subjectivity, here on complexity, we are really considering how complex is selecting the method, how complex is applying the method to actually then develop an accounting estimate. I've put projected unit credit valuation method there in IS-19. That's the method that is actually stated there. So I've just put that as an example as well. And then complexity in applying the data that is actually being used. Is it complex to actually even obtain the data first? Are you using forward-looking information? Are you using historical information? How easy is it to get the information? How easy is it to interpret perhaps the complex, the contractual terms that are there? So that we also then consider in determining how best we can actually then get to a solution. Subjectivity as well. does management have an element of subjectivity here? Perhaps there is no valuation method in the accounting standard, so then management have to decide around a number of methods. And so we need to also then assess the subjectivity to try and see if there is no management bias within the selection of the methods in the data that is being used. And then we gotta have to respond to the risks that we've identified and all the information that we've got around complexity, subjectivity as well. But what we are generally doing when we are responding, we are just checking if the accounting estimate is really in accordance with the financial reporting framework, is it reasonable? We also perhaps look at the industry, what is happening in the industry as well. And then management bias, I just spoke about it around subjectivity as well. So we're going to have to look at all that so that we come to a conclusion that the accounting estimate, the defined benefit plan, for example, is actually reasonable. We've got a number of ways that we respond to accounting estimates. You can see there we've got three ways. One of them, I think you should have heard, or you have heard about subsequent events, something that then happens between year end and before we release our audit report. So you might have an accounting estimate that was put in the financial statements at year end, and then it actually then happens while we are still auditing, before we sign the audit report. Then we are able to then go back and check if that amount that was put in the financial statement was actually reasonable. And we also are able to test how management have actually developed their accounting estimate. And we another option is that we can also develop our own point estimate or range. With that, we can also test the controls around the development of the accounting estimates in an entity, so that at least we just see that the process is also reasonable. There on obtaining audit evidence about events occurring up to the date of the auditor's report, which is the subsequent events, I've just put an example there about perhaps in the financial statements you find that there is an accrual for a bonus and just after year end, it gets paid. So we can then take that amount, the actual amount that was paid, and compare it to what had been estimated, which is sitting in the financial statements, and we can come to a conclusion that the accounting estimate is either reasonable or not, is materially misstated or not. And then on testing how management met the accounting estimate, we can, this is when we are testing and evaluating the methods that have been used, the data, the assumptions that have been used to determine or to develop that accounting estimate. And really this is one of the possible approach for testing post-employment benefits, where we just go and redo what management has done. Developing a point estimate or range, it can be possible for us to actually also develop our own point estimate or range that we will then compare with what management has given us. And it could be another possible approach for us for testing post-employment benefits. And really, the choice on what method to use is professional judgment, but you can we also then consider things like the nature of the accounting estimate itself. In our prior years, if we've been auditing the client in the prior years, how has been the comparison be? So sometimes you'll find that in the prior years, we didn't have a lot of issues, so we might end up just going to testing what management has done. So we can just follow what they have done and test and evaluate what they have done, and it brings us to an appropriate conclusion. And on the point estimate or range, it also depends on, are you able to use your own model? Are you also able to get the information independently so that you can come up with your own model as well? And then once we've responded to that, we then come to a conclusion where we're saying, are the accounting estimates reasonable? Are they misstated? And here, really, what we are then saying, based on the audit evidence that we have obtained, is the recognition correct? Is the measurement correct? Is the presentation correct? Are the disclosures correct as well? And sufficient appropriate audit evidence, we assess whether we've actually obtained that sufficient appropriate audit evidence. And we also then are saying, are the accounting estimates eventually, are they reasonable and are they misstated? That's where we are taking our materiality and bringing it in here and say, is it misstated or not? Is there a difference, and is that difference material? All right. So that is just about how we go through the accounting estimates. And then with the complexities and uncertainties within these, we are sometimes, or we are not, experienced enough to then go through and actually redo what you as actuaries have actually done. So then we then bring in auditors, experts, and here it is you actuaries that we are engaging to then say, come and assist us to audit the defined benefit plan, and I need sufficient appropriate audit evidence for this. This is what I actually need, right? And you, we may find that then it's a management expert as well from another entity who has actually then, from the entity that we are auditing, who has actually developed this accounting estimate. As you can see in board there what the difference between the two are, but you are the same actuaries anyways, just the other one is engaged by the entity and the other one is engaged by the auditor. So you are sort of, our expert is actually redoing the management expert work. And those are just a few examples there. So the experts then come in to help us test the reasonableness of the accounting estimate. And for us, we actually have SNG Agen, our internal experts that we then also, that we use, Cornet and his team. So it's not like it's just this financial or external auditor who is just coming to ask questions about your calculations or about your assumptions and the data that you've used. We're actually also engaging someone who is an expert to come and say, is this really reasonable? I guess that's where now, if ever, you said the conflicts are few, which is good. There are no conflicts because you are using the same standards anyways. So what I'm just trying to say is that we are not necessarily using an audit trainee who is just coming from varsity to come and challenge your assumptions. We are actually using experienced people as well to come and help us verify certain numbers in the financial statements. But we do a little bit of work as well on the auditor's expert's work, because they would have done some work, but we just need to have a look at it as well and just look at their findings so that at least we can come up with a conclusion on our own in relation to the findings that they have actually brought, which is then including, is there a material difference between what our expert and the other expert actually has? All right. That's just about it. I'm just going to then sum this up with a little example so we can just try and understand everything that I was talking about around the estimates. So we've got an entity here that has got a defined benefit plan obligation for its employees. And that entity A has actually engaged an actuary to value the obligation, and their point estimate, the amount that is sitting in the financial statements, is 7.5 million. And so we take this information, do some work around it, risk assessment and all, and what we then say is, this defined benefit obligation, according to our materiality, is it material or not? I've put there our materiality. As an example, it is 3.5 million, which means that line item is actually material for us. And with the risk assessment, the second bullet there, because of our understanding that we've been doing on the entity, I've identified that it's actually complex to value this defined benefit plan because of the uncertainties within it, the complexity within the valuation itself. So that is the risk that we need to then respond to. Our responses then, one of them is really getting Corneille and his team to come and help us with this, with verifying the valuation of this defined benefit plan, evaluate the methods, the data, and the significant assumptions that have actually have been used by the management's expert. We assess the competency, the capabilities, the objectivity of the expert that we are actually engaging. And I've just said it might be different, a little bit different when the expert is internal in the firm, because our systems of control of management control, they would have checked everything around competences, capabilities, also objectivity. But then if you are an external expert, you may find that you are asked these questions by the auditors so that they can actually be happy about your competence, your capabilities, and your objectivity as well for them to get you to assist them. And the auditor's expert elected to develop a range. And I think from what Corneille has referred to, sorry, I'm referring to that because that's the session I was in, and it's talking to what I am speaking to as well, is around having a range, which is the safest. We are going to then also develop our own range, to our own range for that accounting estimate. And the auditors also need to really test the completeness and accuracy of the data that you are actually giving them, so that we make sure that you've given us all the information that is related to this accounting estimate. The expert evaluated the assumptions, the methodology that has been used. You may check it with the consistency with the prior years. You may also then check it with best practice in the industry, check it with the accounting standard as well, IAS 19, that is projected unit credit method, is what has been applied in this example. Can also check if you can independently source some information just to verify the data that has been used by the management's expert. And then the range that the auditor's expert has is actually 7.4 to 7.8. So anything between that is reasonable, right? So the point estimate is 7.5, and if it's within that, then we can conclude that the point estimate, the accounting estimate, the defined benefit plan, for example, is actually reasonable, and so it is not misstated. All right, so I just wanted to sum up that by bringing everything into context, what I was actually talking about. And hopefully I've actually helped someone, and we're going to try and resolve our conflicts between auditors, actuaries, and actuaries themselves as well, because now you understand where the actuaries are coming from when they are helping the auditors as well. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Rinaldo. So any questions from the floor? I don't see any online yet. Comments also, not only questions, welcome.
Comments that can also help us as auditors to understand you better as well.
Actuaries are very, very complex to understand.
So. Yeah, I can imagine.
There in front, and then there at the back.
Thank you. In terms of your sampling approach, did you do like a random selection, or do you have like a risk-based approach? Like, let's say you are checking members' benefits, and maybe just realize that now someone's liability has gone down significantly. How do you do your sampling? Is it random, or is it risk-based based on your assessment?
Well, it depends. So what you're asking is, I've got a number now. I'm auditing maybe 10 items. I've done I've calculated and I'm supposed to order 10 items. How am I selecting those? So it depends. We've got different ways of selecting the items. It can be random sampling, like what you've actually mentioned. We've got systems that we actually use as well that can pick the items for us as well. So it's not really this or that, but it depends. There's also professional judgment involved.
Thank you, Sharmil Bassadin. Thanks for the presentation. I just want to know if you get a report from the actuary with you and your variance is slightly out of your range, would you still accept it or do you fight about the 0.1%? Thank you.
Thank you for that question. So let's say here, your point estimate was actually maybe 7.9, right? So what we then do is we calculate the difference and check whether it's material or not. When it's material, that's when the battle starts. But when it's not material, we accept it.
Maybe I can quickly respond on your behalf on that one as well. The point of the range estimate is not to, as I said earlier, to find fault. It's to get comfort that it's not wrong. So in order for you to fall outside of that range, you really need to get something wrong. It's not a judgment range. The 7.4 versus 7.8 kind of captures judgment, the range within which is acceptable. If you go, in this example, 7.8 plus 3.5 was the materiality level, what does that take us? If you get 11 million, and the answer should be 7.8, something is wrong.
Yeah.
You didn't have the right data, or you didn't, maybe a typo in the report. So that's what we set out to find, is those major misstated errors, not nitpicking on whether you're using a 1% or 2% medical aid assumption. Medical aid is a good example where the range wouldn't be as narrow as that, because in our range that we test, we have a pretty wide range, acknowledging that there is a wide range of acceptability. So you'll end up, we often get challenged by the auditors, why is this range so wide? And that is just the nature of the uncertainty. So when we find something that breaches materiality, that becomes a fight, it is because something is wrong. And then it is worth investigating and digging into it.
Thank you, Corinne.
Is it on?
Yeah.
It's Neville from Sameka. I hear what Corinne is saying. Obviously, big material difference is concern me. But I have, in the last year, seen a lot of times the auditors ask repeatedly the whole shopping list to explain the mortality assumptions, the withdrawal assumptions, every single assumption, how it is motivated, why it was done, and then they would revert to, well, justify it, that type of thing. Do you experience it that way, or is that not? Because, I mean, in a way, I'm not really talking to you. I'm talking, in a way, through you to Corday. So I'm confused because, in one sense, it's a IS 19 valuation. In another sense, it becomes a statutory valuation, and it goes in circles. So I'm just wondering about how that fits.
Okay, thank you for that. I think Corneille will also assist me there. But as I spoke about earlier, is really about audit evidence and having it, having sufficient and appropriate audit evidence. So we would need to understand the data. We need to understand the assumptions that you've used. And we actually then need to understand if those are actually reasonable. Perhaps that's why we then keep asking why you've used this data, why you've used this assumption, why you've gotten 7.1 as inflation when it's actually 6, you know, so that at least we understand where you're coming from and also judge if it is actually reasonable as well. That's really the reason why we then ask those questions.
I keep on grabbing the mic. We probably should have made this a joint presentation.
Yeah.
What we do is, it depends from auditor to auditor or firm to firm. Even within the firm, certain auditors have different approaches. So once they involve an auditor's expert, they pretty much rely on that auditor's expert's view. So if we tell them PA 90 minus 1 is fine, then nobody will ask you, why did you use PA 90 minus 1? If the auditor chooses not to use an expert and he gives it to some junior clerk, he's going to go through his audit evidence checklist and say, they use this assumption, why is this? And they're going to hound you with that. So when you get to that position, ask the junior clerk who's wasting your time, may I please speak to the manager, and ask him, may I please speak to your expert? Because that is wasting everybody's time. When you speak expert to expert, you can resolve it quite quickly. You don't need to provide me evidence why you use PA 90-1. I understand that. And if the auditor trusts me to appoint me in that role, then that will be the end of it. But when you speak to someone who asks you those questions, ask to speak to the boss.
I hope it was not another auditor. It was another expert asking you those questions to justify.
Any more questions? I don't see any hands. Right on time. Thank you very much, Yara. Appreciate that.
Thank you so much.